I'm Kevin Bupp, and this is the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast, where we focus on how commercial real estate produces durable income through execution, not just betting on project returns. Today's guest is Kent Ritter, founder of Hudson Investing, who scaled past 1,000 units by pulling two levers most operators never touch: structuring public-private partnerships to make development deals pencil, and bringing property management fully in-house to control expenses, accountability, and NOI at the asset level. From using municipal incentives to reshape the capital stack to leveraging technology and AI inside operations, Kent's approach shows how experienced operators unlock margin in markets where rent growth and cap rate compression aren't doing the heavy lifting. If you understand where real control and real cash flow is created in today's commercial real estate environment, this conversation is for you. Kent, my friend, welcome back to the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. It's great to have you here again. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Kevin. Thanks for having me on.
It's like talk shop again, as always. It's it hasn't been even a full year since we last spoke, but I think there's been a lot of changes in your business that we'll dive into here today with property management, bringing that in house. I know we're going to talk about some P3 transactions, public private partnerships, and some of those deals that have been very lucrative for you. But before we get into the tactical nature of today's show, let's set the foundation here. So, you've scaled over the years that you've been doing this now, you've scaled Hudson Investing to over 1,000 units. And what did you learn about what truly drive returns?
It's such a good question. And it's definitely, if you think about, I think about when I first started getting into this space, and it was 2015, 2016. And, you think about what happened from there in multifamily, which is what, where I'm at, right? In my space, you think about how much prices exploded, values exploded in that time up to 2019, 20, all the way to 22. Right. And what was interesting in that time is you didn't have to be a very good operator to have success. You could actually be a bad operator and you could really be bailed out just because valuations went up so high, right? Cap rates compressed so much that you made money on your deal. Even if just looking at same store operations, you were worse off. And so, that was something when I first started, because I started by passively investing with other people. And so that wasn't something I really understood at an intimate level. I'm like, oh, you get into multifamily, you just make money because prices just keep going up, right? I'd say now where I'm at, we've acquired, I think, north of 1,600 units now. We've got about 1,000 now that we're managing in the portfolio. And one of the big takeaways is really, man, operations matters. And there's probably nobody more important to the team than that property manager or the management team that's boots on the ground at your property, right? They're the ones that are really taking all these great ideas that you have, that I have, and implementing them, right? They're the ones bringing your culture down to the residents, right? And really creating a positive experience. And if you don't, I think what's been proven out time and time again over the last 3 years since we hit 2022 and interest rates went up and inflation went crazy for a while, right? Was if you're not a good operator, if you can't operate day to day, if you can't manage to key metrics and benchmarks, and if you can't make decisions on the fly and solve problems, then you are not going to be successful in this. And so that was really what was very eye-opening for me. Was I think a lot of people, and especially when you first get into it and you're thinking about what's on Instagram, right, or what's advertised, everybody talks about how to buy a property. Nobody talks about how to run a property. And when you think about the life cycle of one of these, right, we hold on average for about 5 years. That first 3 months where you're buying is a fairly short amount of time relative to the 5 years or even 7 years in some cases that we're owning the property and having to manage it. Right. So it's just interesting. I think when you see what's advertised and what's flashy versus what really creates money, but I think that's in any business, right? It's the nitty gritty operations, the non sexy stuff that really makes money, in almost any business.
No, I agree with that. I mean, you could do a great job at identifying and locating what is a maybe, below market priced property, with mm-hmm. a strong foundation, fundamentals in place, and you could buy it right. Right. Everyone says you make your money to buy it. And there's a lot of truth to that. There's a lot of truth. Cause if you overpay, you might not be able to hold it long enough. But it's not always true, because if you do a horrific job at the operations piece of it, you sure as heck could lose money. Even if you made the money on the buy, you could lose it during the period of, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, however long you hold it, right? If you just do a horrific job and you're running into the ground. So operations does matter, and it's a big component. And you know, I think the other aspect that a lot of folks maybe get wrong or misunderstand till they dive in like you is, I mean, I know that you originally used to outsource and leverage third party management companies, which is pretty commonplace, right? Like that, yeah. That's very common within not just multifamily, but any commercial real estate asset class. I'd say probably mobile home parks are the one exception where that is just not as commonplace because there's just not as many large professional, you know, local, regional or national management teams that are out there. And so there's not many options. So we're kind of forced to go vertically integrated. And so we've known that game since the beginning, but I think a lot of multifamily operators just tend to think they can outsource it, right? And just manage the manager, right? It's just as easy as that. Just manage the manager. You always hear that phrase. So I would love to know, now that you've brought in-house, you guys have brought the property management in-house. What is it? I mean, just if you had to pick maybe a couple of the biggest levers that you've been able to pull since bringing it in-house that you've really seen that has driven the NOI, you know, driven the growth of the operations that you can, we're going to take out cap rate compression. We're going to take out rent growth and any of those other things really. But what are some of the other levers that you've been able to tweak that have really, you know, moved the needle?
The one thing I would say, and I think it's a perfect segue, right, of what we just said and going into why you would want your own property manager. And it's like, you mentioned some really good points that like, you have to buy in a good market. Like 100% it starts with that. You want to buy a good property with good fundamentals. Those are all, like, I think of the analogy, like rising tide raises all boats, right? Those are all the rising tide. But if your boat out of the other boats has a hole in it, it doesn't matter, right? You're still going to the bottom. And like, that's how I think about the operations at the property. It's like, cause I agree. I think every property we've bought, I truly believe we are in a good market. We bought at a good basis, you know, and we made the right decisions going in, but we still have had properties that have struggled. Then you say, wow, if all the fundamentals around me and there's these tailwinds and things are happening, then like, why are we struggling? And as I really reflected on that over the 6 years that I've been really operating full time, it all came back to management and it all came back to really this third party management, right? And having third party management. And the issue is that to me, it's like another great analogy, like nobody's going to love your baby like you do, right? Nobody's going to take care of it like you would. And that was really how I felt. And we kept running into issues, you know, implementing our CapEx plans. We kept running into issues with overspending, and I'll bring this back around to your question, because these are like some of the levers. You know, we kept running into issues, and this might be different properties in over 6 years, but issues with resident retention, right? When I know that we should be, because I know we're priced well, but the problem was the residents weren't getting a good management experience, right? So when it came up to renewal, they were leaving. And it's really hard to keep your occupancy up, even if you're bringing a lot of new people in, if you can't keep the people that are currently living there, you know? And so all of these experiences brought me, obviously you just think, yeah, manage the manager. But you know, you can only get people that really aren't like, really don't care like you do to care and move so much, you know? And especially when you're in some ways asking them to do big things or make big changes with CapEx or, you know, add a kind of a complex business plan. And so I think when you think about having control of management, that's why even earlier in the curve, right? Because I had always been told by mentors and others, you need to be about 2,500 units to bring management in-house to pay for the overhead and the software and everything that you need to really make it run. But I mean, we're about 1,000 units right now, and I'm really happy that we brought it in. You know, we've been able to carve out, you know, small margin, not much, but we've been really efficient in how we've done it. We leverage a lot of technology, offshore resources and things like that. But where we've really seen improvements early on are in a couple places. I think really around expenses and just spending, definitely on, let's say one of the biggest impacts is on just fixing things versus replacing everything. So we had a property where we just kept getting hit over and over again with full HVAC replacements. I mean, the tune of $80,000 to $100,000 in a year. And as an owner, you're just kind of like, what's going on? And you're not getting good information because of a third party. And you're really just seeing it on the financials. And you're like, what happened? You have controls even in our contract for spending that they're supposed to come to me for anything over $2,500, but they just weren't. And once you find out it's on the financials, I mean, it's been spent. Like you can't go back. The thing's in the unit, right? And so just over and over again. So one thing we were able on that particular property to bring, since we've taken over, we brought our like overall expense load, including our CapEx, down about 30% because we started fixing things. So we started replacing parts instead of replacing entire HVAC systems. Because unfortunately the manager was there, was just hitting the easy button and was just, oh yeah, full, here you go. And just spending like a teenager with dad's credit card. And that's really, I think, unfortunately, like I said, nobody's going to care like you do, right? Nobody's going to care about your P&L. Nobody's going to care about your returns, your investor returns. At the end of the day, I mean, if it's not in-house, they're going to care about making a profit for their company. Their company has a profit motive, right? It has to be built into all your costs. But largely they're going to care about, getting their paycheck and going home. And I mean, that's largely what we experienced, unfortunately. And so that's why we made the decision early on, earlier than I would have originally planned, to say, hey, look, if we're going to have to continue to deal with this headache and frustration, why don't we just do it ourselves? Because if I'm going to have a headache, I'd rather it be about starting a business that I know could be great than just dealing with mediocrity all day.
Well, I love that you've been able to somewhat debunk that myth of, need to be at 2,500 unit scale. And I think it goes to the point of what you mentioned, using a mixture of domestic and then non-domestic workforce along with AI, mm-hmm. right? Technology is there. It's mm-hmm. at our fingertips. It's there for us to leverage. Honestly, I think that we talked about this a little bit before we started here. I think in order for, in the next 3 years, property management companies that actually don't adopt not just technology, but AI, and find a way to integrate it into their operations, they're going to be left behind in the dust. They literally won't be able to be competitive, right? They won't be able to offer a competitive product for those in the market that have adopted that technology and can now offer property management at a cheaper rate or whatever it might be. So, I mean, I think there's a way today. It might not have been the case, even just 3 or 4 years ago to do it affordably at 1,000 units, but you've been able to debunk that and kind of basically, spearhead that and prove that it could be done. So I love that.
And I'll just tell you kind of how, I mean, cause we're not skimping on software. I mean, I wouldn't say overspent, but we've spent a lot on software and on technology. And where we've tried to pull back on is on physical bodies, right? On FTEs. And because my thought process in running businesses has always been more like the Navy SEALs than the infantry, right? I would rather have a small group of highly talented people, give them great tools and let them do a lot than have a whole bunch of people and you're just throwing bodies at the problem, right? And I think that's what a lot of property management is. That's traditional property management. Throw bodies at it. You got this many units. Okay. You need this many people. Nope. Doesn't matter. Just you got units to people and we got to have that many people on site. I can tell you what, I mean, one of the property management companies we let go is because, I mean, we had 158 unit property and they demanded that we had 5 people on site and then they wanted a 6th. And I'm like, guys, this is twice just the industry average. Like, I mean, clearly you're just being inefficient at this point if you need this many people. And so guess what? We got rid of them and we actually kept the best people on that team. And we're running it at a normal, a normal load of people and proven, yeah, you actually don't need double the industry average. And so just extreme examples like that. But where we've really leaned in is on AI. I mean, AI is a great, so many good use cases in property management, right? I mean, so much property management is just answering easy, repeatable questions over and over again, right? Think about leasing. It's like, What are the rents? What are the floor plans? Do you allow pets? What kind of pets, right? What are your fees? Like, and the solution a couple of years ago, even back to maybe 5 years ago, was you would have these bots, like these chat bots, right? And you would tell them, like, here's the 20 answers that you can provide, right? But it was rules-based. It was like, if they say this, you say this. Where it's evolved is now with AI, you create a knowledge base where you teach it, hey, these are things about the property, but then it can be so just incredibly more fluid in the conversation and pulling information. And it actually tells us, hey, here's a question I couldn't answer. Here's how the person that stepped in answered it. Should I answer it in this way in the future? And it actually builds on its knowledge based on the people that are interacting. And so it's just super cool. But like I don't have an exact number, but I can tell you, I mean, our collections have improved, immensely. Not necessarily overall collections, that's improved some, but in the time it takes to collect all the money in a month, I mean, we've compressed that in probably half. Because if you think about somebody who's busy on site and they're like, oh, I got to send out collection notices. Like, honestly, it just usually falls to the bottom of people's lists, you know, and they have to send out individual emails or individual texts. The AI can send out 10,000 emails and texts like that. And it just does it. And it does it on a schedule, and it actually learns, hey, these are the people that pay. This is the schedule this person pays on. And so I'm going to change how I reach out to them to try to get them to pay faster. It's pretty cool. But we've seen just, you know, collections, leasing questions, maintenance triage is another great one of just being able to triage. Is this actually an emergency? Is it not? You know, provide helpful solutions. But anybody that calls in now is really encountering AI, whether it's call, text, or email, they're encountering AI before they encounter a person. If they call in to one of our properties or for a maintenance ticket or things like that.
Have you considered leveraging now this infrastructure that you've built out? And I know you haven't perfected it yet, right? You've made the switch here in the past 6 months or so. I'm sure it's still an evolution every day, but is there a point in time where you consider, offering your property management as a third party service to others?
I don't know. It's too early. My intent of bringing property management in-house was not to make a margin. It was really to gather control, like make sure we had control and make sure we could make each of our properties perform the best that they possibly could. When you get into third-party management, then it's about making a profit. You all of a sudden have clients. I feel like it's a whole different animal. So I don't know. I should never say never, but it's not on the horizon right now. Right now, it's about getting really, really good at managing our own portfolio. And luckily we're acquiring property at a pretty decent clip where it's keeping us pretty busy on our own.
Obviously the task is not a light one to bring it all in house, right? Like it, and I know you guys did it in a couple different steps. Didn't bring it all in once, but still like you did a lot in the last 6 months, right? And so I'm sure there's still things that are breaking today, but what are some of the big, you know, the unexpected, you know, big areas where you just had challenges, things broke, the system broke, and you had to, you know, reallocate, you know, resources internally to adjust for it.
Man, the biggest one, and is like, I hate to just put them on blast. So I'll just say our property management software, we were essentially sold what feels like a hill of beans, but a very, very well-known property management system. Almost everybody in the country is on version 7. They sold us version 8. You know, yeah, this is the new thing. This is going to be amazing. Yeah, it's the same, blah, blah, blah. New functionality. I mean, when we turned it on, it was about half built. And the answer that we kept getting was, oh, well, just go back in version 7. You can do it in there. It's like, oh, well, we bought 8. What are we doing here? And so honestly, the biggest complication, and it just became a massive, massive time suck for my team, were just software issues. I mean, literally you'd go in like to try to approve a journal entry and just the button wouldn't work. Like it'd be grayed out. Like you just couldn't even do it. It was just crazy things. And so the biggest thing was that was unanticipated was just massive software issues, because everyone on my team had used this software for 20 or 30 years. That's why we chose it, you know? So we expected it to be smooth sailing, but that was the biggest one.
And so what was the remedy there? Did you switch out of that, or are you just working with it?
No, we just powered through it, and we kicked and screamed and yelled and threatened to burn their house down until we got the solutions that we needed. And we just had to keep going up the pole. I just kept telling the team, okay, well, who's their boss? Okay, well, who's their boss? Okay, well, who's their boss? You know? How do we get a solution here? And, you know, I guess silver lining is that that brought us to one of the great AI tools we use, which is a tool called Elise AI, because the CRM functionality was completely just didn't work. I mean, we were literally managing leasing on Excel spreadsheets and paper.
Oh boy.
Wow. Because it just literally the CRM didn't work. So, you know, that led us to quickly call everybody I knew, hey, what are you using? What are you using? What are you using? And we found a great tool. I mean, in Elise, and I'll say their name because it's been good, has been fantastic. It's one of the AI solutions that we use.
All right. Fantastic. And that's Elise. Is it like A and then L-E-A-S-E or
E-L-I-S-E.ai.
Okay. Got it. Guys, we'll make sure we put that in the show notes.
Yeah. And it's been a great product for us. But yeah, but just, I mean, just leaning into different solutions, you know, there's another, like one of the things I always struggled with was just getting information out of systems, like, especially as a third party, right? When you're trying to ask someone else, hey, send me reports, right? It was always like pulling teeth and they'd always see to the financials, but that's 45 days old. Like that doesn't do me any good, right? To solve problems. So that was my big thing of like, how do we get ahead of things? How do we get data when we can still act on it? And so one thing that we did was, you know, we went out and we found a great, just a great dashboard where it gets a daily feed out of our property management system. Now I feel like I got to just say property management the whole time. And we got a great feed out of the system and it's a daily feed. And then it has like this AI component layered over it. So it's got all the visualizations and trends and things, to let me make decisions quickly. But then it actually has an AI component they just went live with where now. And it uses ChatGPT and a couple other of these large language models, but you can go in and you can just ask it questions, right? Like I can say, hey, you know, look across my properties, you know, and tell me which of the ad sources are performing best. And then tell me how to optimize my ad spend to maximize those sources, right? Like that's something I was asking it the other day. And it came up with a whole plan on, hey, these are the ones that are working. Here's where you should spend more money. Here's where you should pull back on. So just, things that would take, you know, a person hours or days to figure out, it can just parse that data so quickly and provide quick answers.
And that integrates directly with your PM software, correct?
It doesn't integrate directly, but it gets a daily feed. So we okay. run reports out of property management.
Just an automated email.
Yeah. I mean, I think it even is a transfer behind the scenes. I don't even think it's an email, but it happens automatically. But yeah, it happens on the back end. But it's just, it's not real time, but it's daily.
Awesome. Well, good deal. Well, we'd love to switch gears here, Ken, if we could. And, yeah. Would love, I know there's another area that I definitely want to chat about here during our time together, and that's P3 or, you know, public private partnerships. I didn't know what a P3 was either until a couple of years ago. So I know you'd mentioned that earlier. Yeah. But public private partnerships were basically,
here I learned I've been doing them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you've done three, right? I've been involved in one, years past, but basically, you know, in fact, I'm going to let you define it for us because I was about to do that, but you've done more than I, so you probably have a better definition of what they are. And so I know you've done a number of them. Give us the mechanics of what that looked like. Either what were the benefits of going that route versus just going the, you know, entirely private route that a lot of developers do? So,
yeah. So, okay, let me try to start at the beginning. So the public private partnership, right? The public aspect is typically a municipality, right? So it's going to be a town or a city. Could be state, could be a county, but a lot of times it's town or city. The partnership is that in one way, shape, or form, because there's a lot of different ways you could do it, but the partnership is really that they are either co-investing or they're maybe providing land or they're providing, maybe it's a tax abatement. It could be a lot, it could come in a lot of different ways, but they're essentially providing an incentive for you to build a building there because they believe that building, whatever it may be, for me, it's multifamily, usually with retail on the first floor. It's usually a mixed use property that's going to provide a positive economic impact to their community above and beyond whatever they're providing. Right. So it's a win-win for everybody. Right. Which is kind of cliche, but that is the intent. And it's really in my eyes, the only way to get, at least on the multifamily side, market rate development done at this point in time with where interest rates are and construction costs have gone. The reason it's become so popular is because I think if you were to not if you were to try to just do it privately without the partnership of the municipality, I don't think that you're going to have returns that are attractive enough to attract most smart investors. And I'm not going to say you're not going to attract investors, but I'm going to say if investors really understand risk reward, that risk of a new development is going to be too great for the reward, because the amount of equity you have to raise is just is too low, right? So you have to spread the gains, the return across too many people, right? Too many dollars. And so it just dilutes. So like in the examples that I've done, have really been, so we've had a property where they've donated land, but all of our properties have had what's called a TIF component. So tax increment financing. And what that is simply stated is essentially the city is saying, we're going to forego our taxes on this the increase in the taxes on this property from turning it from just a piece of land into an apartment building. Right, we're going to forego that for a period of time because we think the economic impact of having this building here and bringing these people into our town and the businesses into our town is going to be greater, is going to be more positive than those taxes we could have gotten. Right, and so the powerful thing is then because they're foregoing those taxes, you know, we can go and we can actually sell those what would have been those taxes to someone else. And we create a bond. So the future taxes of the property are an annuity. They're an income stream into the future, right? We go to a family office, or there's a lot of people that do this, and sell that future income stream for the present value of that future income stream, right? And so it's like when you're buying a bond, and these often are structured as bonds. And so we sell that, and that's how we get money today into our deal. So instead of, so for example, on a property that we built, we had, you know, it was about a $16 million property. We got a $2.5 million TIF bond from the city. And so we were able to go and sell that $2.5 million worth of, like sizing related to future taxes. We were able to go and sell that for, I think it was about $2.2 million. And so we were going to take $2.2 million and put that into our project day one as equity that doesn't have a return expectation. So the powerful thing was instead of having to go raise $7 million of equity and spread all the returns across $7 million, we had the TIF bond for let's just call it 2.5 for simple math. And then we went out and we raised $4.5 million of equity. And so now we're spreading the returns across $4.5 million of equity, which drastically increases the returns for our private investors, right? The people that we raise money from. And it makes the whole project feasible because we have people that are actually interested because it is the right risk return kind of dynamic. And one of the reasons that it's become so needed is because as interest rates have gone up, construction loans have gotten more expensive and you just get less leverage. So the average construction loan right now might be 60 to 65% loan to cost, where historically it could have been much higher. And it's really that TIF component I talked about that's filling that gap in the capital stack that allows us to still market great returns to our investors. And, you know, and so that's really maybe complicated, but that's kind of the essentially what it is. It's you're taking this income stream and you're selling it to get money into your deal today.
No, that's great. Great explanation. Lots of benefits. I'm sure there's also some nuance associated with it. I mean, I guess you've done three now. Have they all been in a similar structure and format?
They've all been in a similar structure and format. The TIF bond has. It's really been a rinse and repeat process for us with the same partner who's buying them from us as well. And so there's definitely, once you do your first one, it becomes a lot easier, because it is a certain amount of rinse and repeat. But there's been other components where we've gotten grants as well. There's a property where there's a pretty cool trail system in the town, and we were able to get a grant from a local foundation to actually attach into that trail system and create trailheads and build it into the property. And so that was pretty cool. We had another project where the town actually donated the land, because we, the land had an old gross like warehouse on it. So they donated the land to us. We went in, we tore down the warehouse, right? We did all any remediation that was needed. And now we're building a brand new apartment building. But it's all about really being able to effectively communicate to the town, to, you know, the staff of the town, you know, the economic development folks, to the town council or to the mayor, if it's a city, but also to the people. So this process is not easy because it involves standing up in front of a group like you see on Instagram or somewhere, you know, and people yelling at you and bringing the pitchforks, you know, and the torches and the, and, you know, the, and the list of signatures, you know, because anytime there's change, you're going to have people that don't want this, right? So it's about really having a compelling message about the overall benefits, the economic benefits, cultural benefits, whatever they could be for the town or the city, and really getting the people that are involved in the decision-making bought into that and understanding that. And really, it's important that they become the advocates for this, for your project. That's what's really important.
I guess obviously you've learned a lot, you know, everyone you do, you learn quite a bit more. And, but like, I guess, have you leveraged like a consultant to help you, you know, guide you and navigate you through this process? Or did you guys just kind of, you know, trip and fumble through it on your own?
No. I've had a fantastic mentor who's done this for 20 plus years, who really has been like my phone a friend. You know, and we've partnered on some of these together as well. But even when I've done them on my own, it's been kind of that phone a friend on, hey, you know, how do I approach this? How do I do this? And so he was really instrumental. I think if you didn't have somebody like that, I mean, it's a complicated process. And how do you really know where to start? It would be almost impossible. It would be very difficult to figure out on your own.
Yeah. So maybe not like, not a formal consultant, but you had someone help you guide you that's been or done that.
Yeah. I mean, there are attorneys and people that specialize in this, but yeah, I mean, you just like anything in life, like there's people that have done it before and been successful. It's definitely a, you know, faster to find those people and try to leverage their knowledge than try to learn from square one.
Absolutely. So where my head goes, as you talk through this, you've done three now successfully. Obviously you've it sounds like you've been happy with the end result of the entire process and the project itself. And so where my brain goes is like, can you turn this into a scalable model? Is there a slight change of focus to what you guys are doing today to where you could do a number of these in any given year? Like, we've got a target now this year. We know what we don't know. We've kind of learned going through the motions. I think we can do 6, 10, a dozen of these in any given year. Like, how do you get to that scale? I'm sure there's groups out there that's predominantly what they focus on. Maybe your mentor, like that's where he found his niche, right? Where he really, found his path and spent most of his time over his career. So, is that the opportunity that you guys are seeking?
You know, we look at it as more of an and to what we're already doing, which is acquisitions. And that's kind of the bread and butter. And what I've always done is acquiring and improving properties that already exist. But I mean, we just found this opportunity with this pretty unique, skill set to kind of do it in addition to. So our goal is really to have 1 to 2 of these projects going on all the time. You know, and whether it's something that we're generating ourselves or it's through a partnership, we've been able to do that. And so that's kind of like, we have 2 buildings under construction right now that are, that came out of these public private partnerships. And so, and we'll continue to do that in 2026 and 2027. Can it be repeatable? Absolutely. It can. Because I think it's like anything. Once you build a track record, you know, I think one thing that's so powerful for my mentor is he can now point back to a 20 or 25 year career of helping municipalities succeed and having positive results. Right. And so he can say, hey, look what I did here, 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 and here. Right. Don't you want that for your town? And it's really easy for people to see the impact it can have. And so yeah, I agree. It can be replicable. And I think especially once you find the key players, once you find your team, right? You talk about a lot about a team, right? Like at the end of the day, you got to build a building. So it's like, you got to do this whole complicated TIF thing, but like you got to develop a building. You know, you have architects and engineers and general contractors. And once you put that team together, I mean, the second one is a heck of a lot easier than the first one.
I mean, how does one go about finding where these opportunities might exist or where there's municipalities that are, you know, open-minded and actively seeking, you know, P3 type projects? I mean, are there like dedicated forums and groups out there that help facilitate this?
You know, there probably are. I don't really know them, but there probably are.
Probably just knowing a couple local attorney contacts that like that have their finger on the pulse of what the town's doing.
Might have all been fairly serendipitous. Like the first one that we did, we actually owned the property next door, and it was really, hey, there's this 4 acres of land sitting here. Let's see if we can buy it. And then it was like, oh, let's do this TIF thing, right? Let's figure that out and let's find somebody that knows how to do that. And, you know, and then we got a little more professional, you know, about it in finding, opportunities. But it's interesting, right? Because I think there are towns, it kind of goes in this cycle where you've got, as bigger cities get built out, this is what I'm seeing around Indianapolis, as bigger cities get built out, you have, you know, development goes from here to here to here to here to here, right? And keeps moving out. And there's like this curve where you have, if you're too far out from where the development's happening, you're too rural as a town and you're not interested in changing, right? You want to be a small town. People live there because they don't want to live in the big city. And that's kind of what they are, right? And then you get too close to where the main development is. And those are oversaturated. And those towns that have become cities are now like the belle of the ball. And they're like, you know what? We don't have to give anything away because everybody wants to be here, you know? So pay up if you want to be here. And it's kind of in between those where you find these cities and towns that are realizing change is coming. And maybe they're more forward thinking and they're saying, we want that change to come to us. We want to be a part of it, right? Not just be reactive as all of a sudden the subdivisions, you know, our cornfields turn into subdivisions around us, right? And it's there where there's that opportunity, I think, where they still know to get the growth to come there versus five other towns, they need to incentivize the growth, right? But they're open-minded and they understand they want to change and they understand that change can be positive. And so those are the places that you want to find. It's kind of like this donut band around probably these major cities, right? That I'm just describing. And so that's, I just formulated that. So I might take that and put a graphic around that.
The donut band?
But that really is really where the opportunity lies. Yeah. Because we'll go and talk to places, you know, and they're like, everybody wants to be here. We don't need you. And for us, we just know our investors won't invest, you know, on a new development for a low return if you don't have this. And then there's others that are too far out. And I've experienced both sides of it. And it is, you could probably kind of ban this geography around the areas that are ripe for this.
You want to trademark that on the show while we're at it? TM?
Should.
Donut band?
I should. Yeah.
Love it. That's good. No, it's a good visual. Everyone can actually look at that visual and understand what you mean there. And so in your donut band, for the most part, I believe is it Indianapolis for the most part? I know you're a couple other markets, but you're based in Indy and that's kind of your primary focus, correct?
That's where we've done all of this type of work. Yeah. All of these partnerships have been in and around Indy, up to about 2 hours north of Indy in kind of that one, it falls, I'd say, outside of my band, is a unique situation where you've got, okay, so here's another opportunity, is where you've got a small town that maybe has a major global anchor business that is like, made this whole town, right? Just this pocket of success, right? So there's like, for example, in Indiana, there's a town called Warsaw, Indiana, and it's where Zimmer Biomet is based, you know, which is one of the largest orthopedics manufacturers in the entire world. And because of that, this town just has a different demographic mix than the normal kind of rural Northern Indiana town. And so there's a good opportunity there.
Got it. Now that's fantastic. Well, Kent, man, as always, this has been a great conversation, incredibly enlightening. I'm glad that we had the opportunity to talk to P3 Investments. I don't think I've ever had anyone on the show where we've actually covered that topic. So, hopefully that brought some value to folks that are tuning in. I mean, it's at the end of the day, like you have found an additional way, another arrow in the quiver, right? To create opportunity where it didn't necessarily exist before. So I love it. Yeah. For those that want to learn more about you and your group and, you know, the different projects you guys have working, where's the best place to find you?
Yeah, you can go to hudsoninvesting.com, HUDSON investing.com, or you can check me out on Instagram. It's Ritter on Real Estate. Also the name of my podcast where Kevin has been a guest. It's called Ritter on Real Estate. And you can listen to that anywhere.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. Well, my friend, again, thank you for coming on the show. And guys, thank you for tuning in and listening here today. And you know, as always, if you've enjoyed the episode, please do take a moment to subscribe, leave a rating and review. It really helps us continue bringing great guests on the show like Kent. And so with that, until we meet again on next week's show, I'm wishing each and every one of you strong deals and even stronger cash flow. Take care.